Okay. We can pass these around with devotees. But keep them nice. I'm going to take them back. No, I don't think so. Yeah, I'll take one actually. My armor. Jaya Radha Madhava Jabihari Madhava Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivaradhari Jasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Jamuna Tera Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Madhava Kunja Bihari Jayam Vishnu Bhavanamanta Parigraja Kachari Yashvatara Shuta Shri Shri Mahari Sivayan Grace Srila Prabhupada Ki Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Gaura Premanandi All glories to the Simla devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Agnana Tamirandasya Nananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Swabhadantikam Vancha kalpaturubhyascha kripa sindubhyarevacha patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadarha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Can't eat in the temple. You can't eat the burfi in the temple. Yeah. Just FYI. The temple room is supposed to be the place for Krishna's sense gratification exclusively. So, we shouldn't eat the burfi. I remember when I was new devotee, when I found that out, I wouldn't want to eat the burfi even in the hallway because that's in the purview of Krishna's vision. So sometimes I would take it to the side. You know how you eat like half of it and then you want to relish that half before you eat the other half. So then I would want to cross the temple room, and while I would cross the doorway, I would stop chewing the burfi and then finish relishing when I got on the other side. So that's just a fun story. Hare Krishna. So we have this little sheet of paper in the hand. It shouldn't be unfamiliar. We sent it to the Brahmachari group probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's part of the Bhagavatam booklet. It has it gives summaries of the chapters and outlines and various sorts of things like that. So I just printed out a portion of it. You can give it back to me after the class so we can keep it nice. So as we're progressing the Bhagavatam, we'll just add more pages. And that way we can have full books in the future. We want to try to take a little different approach to the sixth canto. We discussed it with the authorities, but we didn't get a full confirmation if we could do this. But we're just going to start today anyway. And to try to make a little bit better use of the Bhagavatam class, we'll try to take a slightly more, perhaps we can call it more educational approach to the Bhagavatam. The idea is that usually what happens is when we start the chapter, you kind of follow for the first 1, 2, maybe 3 verses. And then to get through each chapter is taking like 3 or 4 weeks. And so by the time the first week passes, no one knows exactly what's happening in the Bhagavatam. We lose perspective. So that's why we want to take it in this particular sort of way. So that we at least have the outlines, we kind of know what is the flow of thought in each chapter. And hopefully that can make for yourself deeper study, and perhaps in the discussions, greater, let's say, level or intensity of participation. So that's the idea of this. I'm going to, before we get to this, so Bhagavatam, we know, has 10 topics are covered in the Bhagavatam. Yes, you know this point? How many of you know this point? 10 topics covered in the Bhagavatam? Do you know what they are? You can state all the 10 topics. You know what the 10 topics are, Bhagavatam? Just say no, huh? Just some of them. There are 10 topics of the Bhagavatam. You should make note of this, at least in your mind. Sarga, Visarga, Stanam, Poshanam, Uti, or Utaya. Uti, that's 5. Then, Manvantar, Isha Anukata, Niroda, Mukti, and Ashraya. You understand 10 topics now? Repeat. Sarga refers to the creation of the various ingredients of material nature by the Purusha avatars. Understand what is Sarga? Understand? Sean, understand? Visarga refers to the assembly of the material ingredients for the assembly of the gross and subtle bodies using the material ingredients by Lord Brahma. Understand? So, who can articulate what I just said? No. Who can articulate what I just said? Yeah, Sean, thank you.
Thank you. So that's sarga visarga. Stanam refers to the conditions of the conditioned jivas after the creation. So that refers to the conditions means the heavenly regions, the earth region, the lower planetary systems, hell. The conditions that the jivas experience in their material sojourn is called stanam. So that's what we just heard about in the fifth canto, stanam. The geography of the material universe, the various conditions of the conditioned souls. Understand? So this is sarga, visarga, and stanam. Fourth topic is called as poshanam. Poshanam refers to the mercy that the Lord shows towards the devotees, even when they transgress the laws of Dharma. So that sixth canto is primarily dealing with this topic of poshanam. What is poshanam? Who can articulate? Yeah. This is why it's good to see playback. What are people? One thing is spoken, another thing is heard. It details the glories of devotees when they transgress the laws of Dharma. Okay, playback, Sean. Poshanam. Yeah, merciful to devotees, even when they transgress the laws of Dharma. And the idea is here, just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, two verses, Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, what is that? Name Dveshasti Napriyaha, Ye Bhajanti Tumam Bhaktya, Mayi Te Te Shuchapiyam. You know this verse, Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, Name Dveshasti Napriya, that he is equal towards all the living entities in the material world. He does not favor one, or is he against another? He is equal towards all the living entities in the material world. And which means that, so then the question comes, if God is equal to the living entities, why do we see so many unequal conditions in the material world? Isn't it? That question should come up. Why? What is the answer? If God is equal to all the living entities, why do we see unequal conditions in the material world? They're getting the fruit of their karma. So Krishna is just providing equally the karmas of the jivas. He's not discriminating, favoring one and against another. But, two, the verb but means he's talking about something different now. Ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktiya, but those who worship me with devotion, then mayi te te shuchapiham, they are in me because they are attached to me, and I am in them because I am attached to them. Understand? Krishna said, mayi te te shuchapiham, they are in me and I am in them. So in 9.4 Bhagavad Gita, 9.4.9.5 Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say there? That he is in everything and everything is in him. So what is the difference between this verse and then Krishna speaking about his devotees saying, they are in me, I am in them. He already said that in the 9.4.9.5 Bhagavad Gita. So what is the difference then between that verse and this verse? Yeah, he's in the heart of everyone, of course, the super soul. It has to be explained as I just explained it, that the devotees are in Krishna because they are attached to him. And Krishna is in the devotees because he's attached to them. Because this chapter 9 is detailing the glories of bhakti. So bhakti causes the devotee to become attached to Bhagavan, and bhakti causes Bhagavan to become attached to the devotee. Bhagavan, bhakti, bhaktiman. Shukadeva Goswami says in the Bhagavatam that Bhagavan has bhakti for his devotees. So that's mayi te te shuchapiham. So then the next verse is apiche sudaracharo bhajate mamananyaba sadureva samantavya samyavya vasitohi saha. So then Krishna in this verse says, even if my devotee does the most abominable activity, if he is a nanyabak, he should be considered a sadhu. And this is a Vedic injunction, mantavyaha. And then Krishna describes why he should be considered a sadhu. Samyavyavasitohisaha, because he's fixed in his determination to worship only Krishna, to not take shelter of anything else, even if he's sometimes overcome by his conditioned nature. So Krishna appreciates this conviction so much that even if you are a sinful person, his affection for the devotee doesn't go down. That's the point in that verse, Apichesudaracharo, that even if my devotee does something abominable, my affection does not decrease for my devotee. Does that make sense? Can you understand that point? A lot of things. We're not going into the details, but you can play around with your imagination and you'll probably be right. There's a wide spectrum of abominable activities. They have bhakti to me. We're not going to go into the detail of this particular discussion, at least now. The point is that my affection, my devotion for my devotee does not decrease, even if they do something abominable, or apparently so. Does it make sense? Can you understand? In the material world, if you do something abominable, everyone will shun you, isn't it? Who, except for maybe the mother, but even she may have her doubts and so on. If you do something very abominable, no one will care for you anymore, isn't it? Everyone loves you and all these things, but if you do something very abominable, they're not care for you, isn't it? In the material world, it is like that. Even if you don't do something abominable, they eventually not care for you anyway. But especially if you do something abominable, then no one will care for you. But Krishna is saying in this verse of Bhagavad Gita that even if my devotee does something abominable, my affection for him does not decrease. Rather, shipram bhavati dharmatma, very quickly he will become righteous. Why? Because Krishna is always keeping that devotee in his mind. So he very, because Krishna is always thinking of him, and that devotee, shashvat shantim nagachati, he's also repenting and always thinking of Krishna. Then he comes to Krishna. Very quickly he becomes righteous. You understand this point? So that's the same idea of the sixth canto, Poshana. That even if my devotee transgresses the laws of Dharma, Krishna is merciful. His affection for his devotee does not decrease. Understand? Yeah. That's covered in the sixth canto. Also, if he has bhakti, his devotion will not. Krishna's affection does not decrease, but he may chastise the devotee. So, in the sixth canto, primarily three devotees are given to demonstrate this principle, Poshana. First story of Ajamil. He was a very sinful person, but Krishna blessed him. Second story is story of Indra transgressing, offending his guru. So he made offense. So he was punished for that, but still he was protected by the Lord because he has devotion to the Lord. And third story of Chittaketu, Vitra/Vitrasura. And he also, at least apparently, committed an offense to Lord Shiva, but he was protected by the Lord and ultimately brought to the lotus feet of the Lord. So through these three examples and the 19 chapters of the sixth canto, the topic of Poshanam is covered. I think they already must have read about that in the summary of the canto Prabhupada gave. Understand? Poshanam? So then the encouragement of this point is to become a devotee. Mam mana bhava ma bhakto. That's how Krishna concludes. So be my devotee. Look at all the benefits. Who will love you like that? Only Krishna will love you like that. So the encouragement is to be a devotee. Poshanam. Okay, someone had a question about that.
I was hearing, it was explained that this Poshana point is so important that in the very first canto itself, when Krishna first makes his appearance, it's in the pastime with when he's protecting Maharaj Parikshit from the nuclear weapon. So to establish that position of Krishna as the protector. So then, and you just, I asked my question right before you said this one line, so that helps me clear it up. Because you said, so the idea is we should try to become devotees because Krishna will protect us. So that was sort of going to be my question was, why is this point of Poshanam so important? And how do we, kind of apply it in our personal life along with all the anarthas and all our struggles, trying to render pure devotional service but not being able to. So should we just, you know what I'm saying? How should this affect our mental attitude? Because what I'm finding out is that it's not in our hands really to purify ourselves. We can desire to become pure, but whether we become pure or not is not really in our hands. So we could continue with these anarthas for a long time if Krishna doesn't want to take them away.
So you said I answered already, right?
But if he's a protector, then that's, yeah, I guess.
The encouragement is to be a devotee. We can't purify ourselves, but we can think of Krishna. That is within our power. And by thinking of Krishna, Krishna will do the rest of the work. Understand? Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, he describes Krishna's Naimittika Leelas, Krishna killing the demons in terms of anarthas. And Krishna kills most of the demons. So the idea is that Krishna will kill the anarthas. So our business is to think of Krishna. Krishna will do the rest of the work. Hear about Krishna, think of Krishna, chant Krishna's glories. Then Krishna will purify us. So the encouragement is be a devotee. It's a simple message, one that is often missed because being a devotee means surrendering your very soul to Krishna. I remember the idea of surrendering your soul. Sorry, this is totally tangential and a little mundane, but it reminded me of Mortal Kombat. And one of the characters in Mortal Kombat in when the first one came out, which I think his name was like Shang Tsung or something, and he would take your soul away from you. So then the idea of surrendering your soul in the material world always has a very negative connotation, you know, the devil will steal your soul and all these things. And so the idea of surrendering our very soul to Krishna, by the influence of material vibrations, may seem a little daunting and scary. But that's the encouragement of the Bhagavad Gita. Be my devotee. Become fully surrendered to me. And then you are guaranteed my protection, even when there is some discrepancy in character, behavior, etc. That's the topic of sixth canto, Poshana. Understand? Understand? Understand. What is Poshana? You should use the word even if. It's not like if they commit, you're still my boy. Not like that. Even if, due to the circumstances of conditioned life. So that's the fourth topic. Then there's uti. I'm not going to describe all these things. Poshana is a thing. But then there's uti. Uti means the inclinations of the jivas due to their previous actions, which leads to continued material existence. By acting in a certain way, those actions leave impressions in our mind. And those impressions lead to further activities and future bodies. This is called uti. Uti means inclination. So someone has inclination for piety, someone has inclination for impiety. This is due to their previous actions in previous life. This is called uti. Understand? Uti? Got it? Seventh canto will cover the topic of uti. So it describes how Hiranyakashipu was inclined towards sinful activity or against the Supreme Lord. This was due to the idea of the canto is this due to beginningless impressions of the jivas, that they're inclined to some sinful activity. And then Prahlad became inclined towards the Lord because of the influence of Narada. So this is a different idea. By the impressions of association with devotees, one becomes inclined towards bhakti. So this is uti, fifth topic. Understand? What are the first five topics of Bhagavatam? Repeat. First five. Did you hear that? Can you repeat? You didn't hear. I understand that. All right, then next five topics. They're Manvantar, which refers to the pious kings who are the leaders of mankind in the different Manvantar periods. Then there is Manvantar Isha Anukata, topics about the various avatars of the Lord and their devotees, and then the relationships that they have with the Lord. That's all described throughout the Bhagavatam. And then there's Nirodha. Nirodha means destruction. It refers to the condition jivas merging back into the body of the Purusha avatar, Mahavishnu, and the stage called Susupti. Susupti means deep sleep. At the end of material creation, cycle of material creation, then all the jivas, along with their material identities, are merged back into the Mahavishnu, into another creation. Understand? It's called Nirodha. It means for those who don't get liberation, they are sucked back into the body of Mahavishnu, and they rest there, so to speak, until another subsequent creation. This is called as Nirodha. Then there's Mukti. Mukti refers to the attainment of one's pure form beyond the modes of material nature. This is called Mukti. So these are nine topics of the Bhagavatam, and these nine topics is to clarify a tenth topic, which is Ashraya. Ashraya means the shelter, which is Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the shelter of these other nine topics, and he is sometimes called as Brahman or Paramatma according to the way persons worship him. Gyanis know him as Brahman, yogis know him as Paramatma by their worship, devotees know him as Bhagavan. He's the shelter of these other nine topics. Yeah.
you explained the last category as dependent upon one's realization. Does that mean that one could study the Bhagavatam and come to the conclusion that the Supreme Absolute is impersonal? And that would be his ashraya?
No, they couldn't come to that conclusion, but that is an aspect of the person of his personality, if you will. I don't think they can come to that conclusion by the Bhagavatam study. That would be impossible. But they can draw such understanding from the Bhagavatam, certainly, because it's there. Okay, those are the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam. I'm going to put a questionnaire at the end of each chapter. I'm just trying to say, hopefully we can get more out of our participation in the Bhagavatam instead of a space out for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. And then no one knows what the hell is going on after the chapter passes. So that's a great hope. I know it is a great hope indeed. But one can hope. There's nothing more we can do. So now, the first 3 chapters deals with the story of Ajamil. Understand? The story of Ajamil. Who was a devotee who performed sinful activities, but he took shelter of the holy name. So the Lord protected him, despite his transgressions against Dharma and sinful activity. In this chapter, the first 6 verses, now the outline is here of how the chapter flows. That's what this is for. So we can at least see the line of thought. I'm not going to go through the sections of the chapter because you can just look at it for yourself here. But the first 6 verses deal with Parikshit Maharaj heard about hell at the last chapter of the 5th canto. So his heart was pained to hear how the living entities were going to suffer. And so he wanted to inquire from Shukadev Goswami how those conditioned souls can be freed from hell. Because Shukadev Goswami described how they can go to hell. So certainly he can describe how they can not go to hell and be free from conditions. So he wanted to inquire about that. But before inquiring about that, he wanted to demonstrate to Shukadev Goswami that he understood the previous topics that were discussed in the previous 4 cantos. So the first 5 verses is just Parikshit Maharaj reviewing all that he's heard from Shukadev Goswami thus far, showing him that I have understood the previous topics, and now I have this particular question. Can you answer it? Can you understand that point? It's just a nice little subtle point because oftentimes we go on inquiring without having understood the previous topics. And so, and that's discouraging for the speaker or the guru to see that we're not understanding. So, saying it nicely, that we're not understanding, that's discouraging. So, Parikshit Maharaj wanted to encourage Shukadev Goswami by showing that I have understood the previous topics. And so that's what the first 6 verses of this chapter are, just Parikshit Maharaj's review of what he's understood thus far. So now it makes it easy. Now you can just go through the verses. Now you know what the flow is of those first 5, 6 verses. So we're going to go, just like the regular Bhagavatam class, we'll go through the verse in purport. But I will try to, at least if when I'm giving class, I'll ask if we can keep up the standard. But I will try to go through several verses that deal with that one particular theme. So like the theme of this first 6 verses is clear, as I've just described. So I'll try to go through all 6 verses and then in the Bhagavatam class. That way we can keep up a flow of thought in the Bhagavatam. Is everyone understanding so far? Okay, I'm going to give a questionnaire. So I hope you have good memory. Shruti Dars. Everyone has Shruti Dars. You know what a Shruti Dar? Alright, so we're going to recite the verse. Shri Parikshit Uvacha. Navriti Marga Katita Adao Bhagavata Yata Krama Yoga Palabdhena Brahmana Yadasam Shriti. Translation: Maharaj Parikshit said, O my Lord, O Shukadev Goswami, you have already described in the 2nd canto the path of liberation, Nivritti Marga. By following that path, one is certainly elevated gradually to the highest planetary system, Brahmaloka, from which one is promoted to the spiritual world along with Lord Brahma. Thus, one's repetition of birth and death in the material world ceases. Yay. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Since Maharaj Parikshit was a Vaishnava, when he heard the description at the end of the 5th canto of the different hellish conditions of life, he was very much concerned with how to liberate the conditioned souls from the clutches of Maya and take them back home to Godhead. Therefore, he reminded his spiritual master, Sukadeva Goswami, about the Nivritti Marg, or path of liberation, which he had described in the second canto. Maharaj Parikshit, who at the time of death was fortunate to have met Sukadeva Goswami, inquired from Sukadeva Goswami about the path of liberation at a crucial time. Sukadeva Goswami very much appreciated his question and congratulated him by saying, Variyani shate prashna krito lokahitam ripa atmavit samata pumsam srota vyadhishu ya paraha. My dear king, your question is glorious because it is very beneficial for all kinds of people. The answer to this question is the prime subject matter for hearing, and it is approved by all transcendentalists. That's the end of the quote. Parashit Maharaj was astonished that the living entities in the conditional stage do not accept the path of liberation, devotional service, instead of suffering in so many hellish conditions. This is a symptom of a Vaishnava. Vancha kalpaturubhyascha kripa sindubhyayivacha. A Vaishnava is an ocean of mercy, paradukha dukhi. He is unhappy because of the unhappiness of others. Therefore, Parashit Maharaj, being compassionate toward the conditioned soul suffering hellish life, suggested that Sukadeva Goswami continue describing the path of liberation, which he had explained in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. The word samshriti is very important in this connection. Samshriti refers to continuing on the path of birth and death. Samshriti, on the contrary, refers to Nivritti Marga, or the path of liberation, by which one's birth and death cease and one gradually progresses to Brahmaloka, unless one is a pure devotee who does not care about going to the higher planetary systems, in which case one immediately returns home back to Godhead by executing devotional service. Taktwa deham punarjanma naiti. Parikshit Maharaj, therefore, was very eager to hear from Sukadeva Goswami about the path of liberation for the conditioned soul. According to the opinion of the Acharyas, the word Krama Yoga Palabdhena indicates that by first performing Karma Yoga and then and finally coming to the platform of Bhakti Yoga, one can be liberated. Bhakti Yoga, however, is so powerful that it does not depend on Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga. Bhakti Yoga itself is so powerful that even an impious man with no assets in Karma Yoga or an illiterate with no assets in Jnana Yoga can undoubtedly be elevated to the spiritual world if he simply adheres to Bhakti Yoga. Mam evaishasi asamshayaha. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 8:7 that by the process of Bhakti Yoga, one undoubtedly goes back to Godhead, back home to the spiritual world. Yogis, however, instead of going directly to the spiritual world, sometimes want to see other planetary systems, and therefore they ascend to the planetary system where Lord Brahma lives, as indicated by the word Brahmana. At the time of dissolution, Lord Brahma, along with all the inhabitants of Brahmaloka, goes directly to the spiritual world. This is confirmed in the Vedas as follows. Ramana sarate sarve samprapte pratisanchare parasyante kritatmana pravishanti parampadam. Quote, because of their exalted position, those who are on Brahmaloka at the time of dissolution go directly back home, back to Godhead, along with Lord Brahma. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. That's a long purport. So the first point in the purport is that, as I already mentioned, Parikshit Maharaj was feeling pained to hear about the suffering of the conditioned souls who have to go to hell. And therefore, Prabhupada says here, he wanted to remind Sukadeva Goswami, remember that topic about liberation? Can you go back to that one? Perhaps it was too negative for him. And so he wanted a more positive, upbeat discussion. So Prabhupada says here that therefore he wanted to remind his spiritual master about that topic of liberation. And says, remember you said, and then he quotes this verse from the Bhagavatam, you said only that the answer to this question is the prime subject matter for hearing. Not hearing about hell, hearing about how to get out of the material world. That is the prime subject matter for hearing, and it is approved by all transcendentalists. So Sukadeva Goswami, being pained by the suffering of the conditioned souls, reminded Sukadeva Goswami about the suffering, about how the topic of how to get free from material existence. And that way, he gives expression to the devotee's natural characteristic of compassion towards the suffering conditioned souls and subsequently wanting to do something for their benefit. So that's the first point. The second point Prabhupada brings up is on the word Asamshriti. Asamshriti, he says, refers to the Nirvritti mark, or the path of liberation, which is interesting here because the path of liberation here refers to one gradually becoming detached from the material existence. It also seems to indicate movement through higher planetary systems for some level of sightseeing. Prabhupada mentions here that some yogis, they kind of are interested in seeing other places in the material world, so they gradually ascend until they attain the realm of Brahma's planet. And in that planet, at the time of final dissolution of the material universe, they go back to the spiritual reality according to their process, along with Lord Brahma. So this kind of this Nirvritti mark is somewhat distinguished from Bhakti mark, because Prabhupada says here, if persons are simply interested in going back home, back to Godhead, they just absorb themselves in the glories of the Lord. Janma karma shime divyam evam yaviti tatuta. So I think it's an interesting point that Bhakti mark is not exactly Nirvritti mark. In a very broad sense of the use of the word Nirvritti mark, it refers to the path of liberation. And so in that sense, Bhakti can be an aspect of Nirvritti mark. But Bhakti is not exactly Nirvritti mark. Nirvritti mark is referring to something a little bit more specific, a process of gradual detachment from matter, even going through some of the higher planetary systems for a little bit of sightseeing before final liberation. So it's progressive. But for those who are bhaktas and totally uninterested in anything material, any level of sightseeing, then they do Bhakti mark. They just absorb themselves in the Lord and go back home, back to Godhead immediately. So that's the first point. Those are the points made in the first paragraph. In the second paragraph, Prabhupada points out on this word, Krama Yoga Palabdhina, which indicates attaining the status of self-realization through a krama means gradually or step. Krama means step. So gradually attaining the platform of self-realization through the different processes of yoga, beginning with karma yoga, gradually leading to the realization of the self different from matter, which gives adhikar for gyan yoga, and then from there gradually moving towards bhakti. And then with bhakti yoga, of course, going back home, back to Godhead, or according to the process that you take up, liberation into the Supreme and so on. Prabhupada points out here that bhakti is so powerful that it can act independently. It need not depend on karma, or it need not depend on the gradual process from karma and through karma and gyan. Karma yoga depends on a properly established varnashram system. So karma yoga is highly improbable in the age of Kali, for the fact of the matter is there's no varnashram system. There is no proper prescribed duties based on proper natures. No one even knows what their nature is. Gyan yoga depends on karma yoga. It depends on purification of one's existence through prescribed duties. So these processes are all dependent. So Prabhupada points out here that bhakti is independent. And why is it that bhakti is independent? Because bhakti is a gracious grant of a bhakta. And Krishna gives a bhakta the power of attorney to distribute bhakti to himself. Right? Bhakti is not something that can just be attained by effort. I'm just going to be a bhakta, for example. It's not really attained by one's desiring to be as such, but rather it's attained by those who have bhakti. Krishna bhakti janma mula hai sadhu sangha. Lord Chaitanya says that the root cause of Krishna bhakti is sadhu sangha. So in the association of sadhus, the sadhus give the first investment in the form of transcendental faith in Krishna, which leads to surrender to Krishna. And then according to how they've infected us with the desire for pure devotion, then we will intelligently expand the capital in the form of faith until prema. So bhakti is independent because it is given by a bhakta who acts independently from Krishna and the distribution of Krishna's mercy in the form of devotion to himself. And so Prabhupada mentions, for those who have bhakti, they need not do karma or gyan, and they will certainly get the goal of life, namely Krishna. But if for persons who don't have bhakti and they go through this gradual process, karma yoga upalabdhena, then they may rise up to Brahmaloka and from there, liberation. Otherwise, if one is fortunate to gain the association of a bhakta, Then he gets to experience the independent nature of bhakti to free one from material condition without the step-by-step progress. The step-by-step progress is called Bahunam Jamanante process of many births and deaths in order to make progress. So the devotees save us from all of that by the distribution of their mercy. So these are the points brought up here in the purport.
This was brought up in Jivadharma that even in some of the impersonal paths, they utilize bhakti because they see its importance in attaining liberation. So since here you're explaining that actually bhakti is the gracious grant of a bhakta, of a devotee, then the quote-unquote bhakti that's being practiced in other paths isn't really bhakti.
Yes, it's bhakti under the... It's sattviki bhakti, which means bhakti in the mode of goodness. In other words, bhakti assumes a position in the mode of goodness in order to make those processes useful. The processes of yoga are actually not transcendental. They just elevate you in the modes of nature. That's what they actually do. They don't transcend the modes of nature. Those processes alone do not transcend the modes of nature. So bhakti assumes the form of goodness in order to make those processes useful. This is how it's described by many of our acharyas. So it is bhakti, but it's not pure bhakti. It's mixed. And that mixture allows those processes to be successful. Those processes followed alone would not work at all. Therefore, you see people who try these things out in Kali Yuga, they're not able to make much, they're not able to gain much momentum in their spiritual practices usually, because they don't have any element of devotion in it. These Gyanis and Karmi yogis that we hear about in the Shastras, they followed Vedic literatures, and Vedic literatures are given by Krishna. So all those processes are inherently linked to bhakti because it's given by Krishna. But in the modern world, they don't follow any of these authorized processes. And therefore, they don't usually achieve the fruit of self-realization very effectively like that. One needs the influence of bhakti to achieve success.
Brahma Loka, is it still possible to fall down? Because here it's described that they ascend to the spiritual world.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I mean, I don't know of a statement that it's necessary that everyone on Brahma Loka is after liberation. Although the general sense is that it is like that, because like when you read the Brihadaryanamrita, when you hear about the higher planetary regions, the mode of goodness is very intense there. So all very much self-realized persons. Those planets, on those planets, they're all sages, or they're worshiping the Lord in some particular form and so on. So it seems to make sense that most of the entities there would be interested in and Nivriti Marg, becoming free from material existence. Although I don't know any reference where it says like that's necessarily the case, aside from the one we're hearing here. So that's all I can say on that. Are there any other questions, comments, concerns on these points? Yeah.
Part of some of the discussions we're having in Gita also, and that you mentioned, is that our nature is not such an aspect of bhakti, what we're doing. We're following the bhakti dharma, so therefore the varna ashram and things like that are, you know, secondary or not even really so existent. And this came up also in Gita as far as determining our nature. You know, sometimes when I hear Chaitanya Charitamrita, it seems that Mahaprabhu puts a lot of emphasis on these points, particularly for those in renounced order, those who've taken, you know, particular adopted styles of worship or vows, and particularly the ashrams. He does seem to have a lot of impetus that things were, if one's not following their position according to the ashram, either as grihastha or sannyasi, then he would be greatly displeased. And on the contrary, if one was just carefully following those principles, he would become very pleased. So just because I was hearing that and trying to understand that in context of some of the discussion we've been having on that point, maybe you could explain a little more.
That is an interesting point. I mean, when you say he greatly emphasized it, I would actually to clarify, because a lot of his emphasis when he describes sannyas ashram or he describes the duties of grihastha, it was always in relationship to chanting the holy name or exclusively worshiping Krishna. Like in chapter 3 of the Manjulila, where in the beginning chapters describe Lord Chaitanya after he takes sannyas. And he quotes a verse from the Avanti Brahmana chapter of the Bhagavatam, which says that sannyas means exclusively worshiping Krishna. And then when he would, most of his instructions to the Grihasthas, as far as I remember, in both the Chaitanya Bhagavat and Chaitanya Chaitamrita, he would always advise him to constantly perform Sankirtan and to render Vaishnava Seva, and that those were the duties of a Grihastha. And so even when he emphasized following the ashram, it was always in relationship to execution of bhakti. And we don't hear so much of him discussing in terms of just strict Vedic principles alone. In fact, as a sannyasi, in terms of the culture at that time, Lord Chaitanya was a little bit revolutionary because he was seen to be chanting and dancing, singing with a bunch of sentimentalists. Prakashananda Saraswati criticized him for this. That is not the duty of a sannyasi. So even in terms of his sannyas ashram, other sannyasis in the culture criticized the way he was applying that principle as if it was a deviation from the actual culture. So his emphasis on the ashrams was really in terms of devotion more than it was in terms of strict rules as perhaps found in the Dharma Shastras or something like that, describing the detailed work of the ashram and so on. But I know when you're thinking of, like, for example, Haridas, Junior Haridas, Chota Haridas, and Lord Chaitanya was so strict with him because he didn't even really do anything. He went to an old Mataji's house, Madhavi Devi. Madhavi Devi, and Madhavi Devi was such a powerful Vaishnava because it said there was 2.5 people that were considered non-different from Lord Chaitanya. Sika Mihiri was one, there was another one, and then the half was Madhavi. Lucky we don't have Krishna here, she might have been. Anyway, Madhavi Devi was considered the half, you know, she was, but non-different from Lord Chaitanya. And so such was her exalted status. And Chota Haridas goes over there, and he just asks for some rice. Can I get some, for cooking for Lord Chaitanya? And then he gets this first-class rice from Madhavi. He goes, he cooks it. Lord Chaitanya eats it. I think Bhagavatacharya is serving Lord Chaitanya. And so as Lord Chaitanya's eating his rice, this rice is first class. He kept commenting about the rice. This rice is so first class. And he asked Bhagavatacharya, who is where do you get this rice from? So Bhagavatacharya said, Madhavi Devi is given the rice. Lord Chaitanya said, who went and got it from Madhavi Devi? So he just said, like, innocently, oh, Chota Haridas went and got it. And then he carried on, and the Lord Chaitanya, oh. Like that, and then all of a sudden, you know, he finishes his prasad, and then he says, tell Chota Haridas, he is not to see me anymore. He's you know, ostracized from society and so on. And when you hear that Leela, you know, one becomes greatly concerned. Of course, there are reasons, and you know, reasons which are delineated by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta why that was the case. But that's the only case where I can think of Lord Chaitanya kind of indicating. Sure, Lord Sanatana Goswami had a fancy wool shawl that was given to him by Srikant. So Lord Chaitanya, he didn't say anything, but he kept looking at it. You know, they would be doing activities throughout the day, and Lord Chaitanya just kept looking. Like that. So then Sanatana Goswami got, you know, a little uncomfortable. You know, if you come, you're maybe dressed in a nice way or something, everyone keeps... So Sanatana Goswami got a little uncomfortable. So you can understand the heart of Lord Chaitanya. So he renounced it. But I don't know if that's exactly an independent point in the idea of this devotion to Krishna, because it is mentioned also in the sixth chapter of the Anchalila, which talks about Raghunath Das Goswami, that Vairagya is the main principle sustaining the life of the followers of Lord Chaitanya. But it's a Vairagya that's based on taste for Krishna and not as a principle of sannyas. Because Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Dhananyatu Aishu Vairagyam Chayara Gyana Chayara Haitukam. When one has intense devotion for Krishna, and renunciation is a natural principle of that. So, although, like I said, I think one could give a social purport to all those things, but Lord Chaitanya's main emphasis in terms of the application of the ashrams was always in terms of bhakti. And And that too, that was also in India, where there was a fixed cultural setup where even the social explanation could be understood. But now you're in America or other parts of the world where they don't have such a fixed social setup. And so to try to describe our discussion of Brahmacharya Ashram, Grihastha Ashram is really a concessional discussion because we don't have the social context that Lord Chaitanya had, because what it would mean to follow all those things in great detail. You know, to what does it mean to be a properly situated grihastha? You're supposed to go out and scream three times into the street. Are there anyone, how you say? Anyone is hungry? Three times and feed everyone. And before you eat, you're supposed to do that. That's just the duty of the grihastha. The duty of the grihastha is to maintain the other three ashrams. So they should be minimally giving 50%, as Prabhupada has described in so many of his purports. Who does that? And we're quite satisfied, I don't want to say satisfied, but we don't put pressure on the grihastha that you're not following your grihastha dharma. Where's the 50%? For example. So we don't have the social context in which we would understand clearly how to even apply those principles of Vedic culture in a very strict sort of sense. And in fact, Prabhupada indicates, as we read in Lord Chaitanya's Lila, about how he was getting boys and girls to work together, because you can hardly expect to change the social customs of a country immediately. And that the main principle was to spread Krishna consciousness and so on, for example.
I think also in Bhakti Loka, I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur has a few essays that indicate that the principles of Varnashram are to be utilized for the advancement of devotional service, that those principles are applied in devotion as in
Sure.
maintaining. So I just, for myself, it's helpful to keep in mind. And I think sometimes without that understanding, then the tendency just to, in our society, that these things are not important when they do have an application. It's just an area that I wanted
Yeah.
to.
They're important because as conditioned souls, we need some sort of social orientation for functioning. Without a social orientation for functioning, then we'll just act unbridledly according to our conditioned nature. So you need some type of, just like I was mentioning in my Sunday, even to get dressed, you need a certain conceptual orientation just to get dressed in the morning. So you have the conception that I'm a woman or a man, so you put on a sari or a dhoti. So just to do simple activities, you need some sort of orientation. So also for social intercourse, it needs some sort of setup, some sort of set of rules that can some level of guidance for how that can be done. So it is important in that context, but it's not of grave significance, primarily because of the age of Kali, where the rules of engagement are not so clear, and primarily because they're only auxiliary in terms of helping us achieve self-realization. So they, of course, they have their importance in an auxiliary function and helping us understand how to interact in a society, what will be our responsibilities within a society, and how that gives support to the development of our consciousness. But I think we see, quite frankly, we also see practically that it doesn't stop people from being irresponsible. It hasn't really done away with the confusion also in terms of what should be my responsibilities and so on. There's still grave confusion in terms of the topic, like Varnashram. It's a great confusion how it would be applied. One problem with the application is that you need brahmanas, and that already makes it a problem in the modern world, how to apply Varnashram when you don't have brahmanas, or you don't have people who respect brahmanas because they don't want to identify themselves as shudras or something of a lower nature. So it does have its importance, no doubt function it does. But it's not of great significance. I'm going to stop here. I'm going to give class tomorrow, hopefully you don't mind, just so I can finish up the section I wanted to discuss, because I didn't get to finish what I wanted. I'm going to give class tomorrow also, and then someone can give after that.
So I was just gonna ask, would you say it's unhealthy or is it healthy to kind of, because I was just thinking about how my own Krishna consciousness, also for maybe some other devotees, are the guidelines that govern our interactions and govern our, use charity as an example, lifestyle, all these things were simply like instructions by the Vaishnavs. They said you do like this is how one should live, so then we followed that.
Primarily, that's what we're
So
doing practically also, we see. Like, who here has studied what are the duties of a brahmachari? of a grihastha, of a sannyasi. We've heard from the devotees and understood how we should interact, and that's the conceptual orientation that we're working with. There is the seventh canto does entertain a discussion on detail of what it is, and as such, Krishna also does in the 11th canto. But you don't see that most of us are aware of those principles. We're just aware of the instructions of Vaishnavas, and we're just following that. Practically speaking, that's what we're doing. In one sense, it could constitute a weakness because conditioned as we are, we may not know how to interact properly. And because Varnashram was a scientific organization of the natures of conditioned souls, so that everyone could be progressive. And so not understanding that those same natures exist in a disorganized way, and so it can lead to disaster, as it is often seen. So in that sense, it may constitute a fault. But the real fault is that we don't absorb us, which leads to the natures taking over. And because of not being sufficiently absorbed in bhakti, then and the conditioned nature starts to take over, and because we don't have the social organization, you know, it's not properly understood by us, our natures are acting without any context, and therefore it leads to a lot of disastrous situations. So in that sense, it could be a fault. And the real fault is that we're not absorbed in bhakti. And then someone can say, well, I'm conditioned, I can't be absorbed in bhakti. So then it would become important to understand how to have a organized situation where you can subvert the perils of the conditioned nature bringing us down. And we don't have that, so that could constitute a fault in that sense. Yeah.
I like how you mentioned about how one should just dedicate their consciousness to developing bhakti. And I know some devotees said when one develops bhakti, they'll automatically know how to socially interact with individuals because they have an equal view that everyone's part and parcel of Krishna, so there will be no, you know, to really focus so much on the principles of Varnashram, and that can, like, their bhakti devotion.
Yeah, that's okay when you're speaking about, like, atmaretis. Krishna uses this language in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, atmareti, where he speaks about he has no duty to perform, because the purpose of duty is to come to a self-satisfied situation. And then, so the Amarati is already, Amarati itself means self-satisfied, so they didn't perform. Neither he has no reason not to do anything also. And it's also mentioned that his activities are self-illuminated. You know, he gains inspiration from Super Soul, how to act in all situations, because he's so connected by his spirituality. But then what about those who aren't in that situation? So then Krishna advises in that third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, to Arjuna, out of compassion, even if you are Atmarati, you should act within a certain social construct for persons who are not so realized, so that they will know how to act in order to be progressive. So it still can constitute a fault that even though we dedicate our energy to bhakti, we're not there yet. And so oftentimes it is the case that our conditioned nature takes the upper hand. Like I often give the image, because I think it's a good image, of taking bath at the Haridwar, where the Ganges current is so strong that to take bath in that water, they have chains which you have to hold on to, and in order to take bath. And if you let go of the chain for even a second, then you'll end up in the Bay of Bengal. You know, it just takes you down river. That's how powerful the current is. And so our conditioned nature or the impressions, previous karmas are so strong. They're like a strong current acting in our subtle body all the time, which we're identifying with. So that strong current is always pushing us. So bhakti is like the chain that we can hold on to in order to resist the current of the impressions which are pushing us. But oftentimes, bhakti gets a little bit too much for us sometimes, isn't it? We experience the morning program, for example. First day was ecstatic. Second day was ecstatic. You know, first week was like really, it was new. It was ecstatic. Everything was wonderful. Then after some time, you're like, I'm tired. You know, it just comes up in like a seed, like a little seed thought comes in. I'm tired today, you know. And then the next week comes, and especially when you show up and others don't show up. That one really does a number on the mind, doesn't it? When you show up, it's like you there, you're ready to go, and it's like you turn around, and it's like you and one other person. And the rest of the ashram is not to be seen. That one does a real number on the mind. And then what happens is a tendency to let go of the chain, at least for a moment. And when you do that, the impressions of our karma start to take over very rapidly. And therefore, when we don't have a proper social construct and how to operate, then it leads to disaster, actually. Because then our nature starts to act unbridledly without any regulations, nothing to govern protect our nature from victimizing the consciousness. And so it still can constitute a fault that we don't have a clearly established social structure. And what will happen is people who emphasize like the point you're making, when we're bhaktas, then we see that everyone's part and parcel of Krishna and so on. Yeah, right. You know, Brahman Bhuta, attain that platform of Brahman Bhuta is not so easy. You can theoretically talk about, I'm seeing spirit soul. But there's a reason why I don't go in the little girl's bathroom, you know, or the girls don't come in the boys' bathroom, because we're not that enlightened. Sukadeva Goswami was a 16-year-old boy, so that's like you at the height of power, sexual prowess, isn't it? And he's crossing, some young women are taking bath, and they don't have any clothes on, he doesn't have any clothes on, and he is completely peaceful. Now, none of us would be able to do that, imitate that. Even if we theoretically, they're all just parts and parcels of Krishna. You would not do like that. You know, there are parts and parcels of Krishna. You'll be, and will say like this, that we can see they're all parts and parcels of Krishna. Can you really see that? Are you really seeing that? That they're parts and parcels of Krishna? To what degree are you seeing that? Like, just like I tell this story of my friend Atma. I used to hang out with him in the White Hand Pantry, so we can, we called it building, you know, we could build. I don't know if you, any of you familiar with that language yet. Anyway, build means you could build spiritually like that. So I used to hang out with him, and he would always speak about how I'm one with everything, you know, kind of like my buddy. And but when a beautiful girl walked into the store, you know, the White Hand Pantry had like mirrors in the four corners of the store. So I would notice how his eyes would be wandering to the mirrors, while the girl, you know, beautiful girl was walking the stores. So when she would leave, I would inquire, well, if we're all one, how could that be attractive? It's all one after all, you know, we're all parts and parcels, right? He said, yeah, we're all one, but sometimes my vision becomes compromised when, what type of vision is that then? So if you're not so realized, you can theoretically say, I'm seeing part and parcel, but then when a situation comes up, the test if you're seeing part and parcel, then we find out that we're usually not so much seeing part and parcel, and we're seeing something else. Another example I often like to give in this connection is the Matrix. These mundane examples are helpful because I know you relate to them as conditions. So how many of you saw the Matrix? Everyone here saw the Matrix. So you know the one scene where Morpheus is training Neo up, so he puts him into a simulated Matrix program. So Neo knows that the whole program is just a simulation for his training. And then, but in the program, everyone's in like nice, it's like Wall Street or something. They're all in nice black and white suits. But all of a sudden, there's this lady in a red dress. And so Morpheus is, you know, giving his pravachan. And the lady in red dress walks past Neo, and he's like, and he knows it's a simulation, but he's still looking. So then Morpheus says, were you hearing me? And then he turns around and is like, or were you looking at the lady in the red dress? And then Morpheus says, look again. And when he turns around, it's the agent pointing a gun in his face. So in other words, we're not so realized. We may know theoretically it's just a simulated program. But then when the lady in red dress comes, our consciousness is captured. Now, not the lady in red dress, it's the mold of nature bringing you under control. So I find that people who tend to emphasize this idea that bhakti will help us understand that we're all part and parcel, but you're not on a platform. Don't front, you know, as we say in our modern lingo. We're not there in our consciousness yet, and therefore it is helpful to have some sort of structured way of interacting so that our conditioned natures won't so much victimize us. That's hard to establish in the modern world where people are so emotionally attached to their own way of viewing things. So it's very difficult to establish a social situation where it's going to be satisfying for everyone. No one just accepts the shastra, so then you have confusion. And the result, the reality is we're not so advanced in bhakti and our natures are there, so it's just quite a challenge. Practically, I feel the only solution is you luck out and get some shelter from devotees and you just pass out into the material world. That's a personal opinion, by the way, but Okay, so it's 8:30. Is there any final little? I hope you all got the points today. So there's 10 topics of Bhagavatam. We're discussing Poshanam. First chapter deals with the story of Ajamil. The first six verses is Parshit Maharaj expressing that he's understood the previous topics that were discussed, and he wants to inquire about how people can be saved from hell. And we just heard one of those verses today. I'll give tomorrow also so I can finish what I wanted to discuss, which I couldn't finish today. Thank you all very much for tolerating. Can you keep the... You can keep them, but I want them to keep them nicely, because as we move on, I'm going to print other pages just so that at some point... You could... Or they have folders upstairs in the Brahmacharya Ashram in the drawer over there. Maybe you can find you keep it. See, already look at folding it in half and in quarters. See? Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. I said at the very outset, I want to keep it nicely, folded in quarters.
We have different conceptions tonight.
I haven't read the same thing. Yeah, I don't know if people try to describe the Margaret. Yeah. What does that basically mean? Like, I know it basically attains liberation, but that has to be.
I think in principle it just means yoga. The path of yoga by which you become.
So the person can take that route.
Yeah, someone who's an impersonalist is on the path and then reaching art. You know, gradually.